Great. We are going to look. We're going to look at another story from the Tanaitic corpus, from the early rabbinic corpus, and this one is in the a cycle of stories related to Rabbi Eliezer. Now, I like Rabbi Eliezer, not least of which because I was named after him. My parents had this. They were like, you know, young marrieds. This is when people got married young, and when they were when my mom was pregnant with me, they started to learn Mishnayot, with the project of getting through all of it. I think they made it through Pirkei Avot. And in Pirkei Avot, it says about Rabbi Eliezer, Yehi chavod chavercha chaviv alecha kishalcha. The honor of your friend be as dear to you as your own. Which is a very nice statement and, you know, like a lovely person to fulfill those words. But the story of Rabbi Eliezer as a person in the sort of Tanaitic literary history is one that is very complex. And in fact, I would argue, a friend of mine once proposed this theory that all of Pirkei Avot, when it says these sayings in the name of X rabbi, that the saying is actually a mini autobiography. So each person who says whatever they say is in fact summing up their life. And for Rabbi Eliezer, his life is summed up in this idea of Yehi chavod chavercha chaviv alecha kishalcha, let your friend's honor be as dear to you as your own, having lived a life in which his own honor had not actually been respected by his colleagues, which we're going to investigate a little bit as we look at this story. So he's a fascinating character, and I mentioned that Daniel Boyarin writes about the division between the Jews and the Christians, and how this is not actually a it wasn't an like easy thing, but a sort of ongoing process. And one of the figures he uses to illustrate his point is Rabbi Eliezer. He is somebody who seems to have had some interaction with Christianity and may, in fact, have adopted some of the Christian, at the time, Christian ideals, if not practices, that put him in this, as Boyarin says, this borderline case. He's part of the borderline when Judaism and Christianity was still figuring out what is the distinction between Judaism and Christianity. So what we're going to do is read this story about Rabbi Eliezer, who is arrested for being a Christian. And what I'm going to ask you to do is just the very first source here, which goes until the middle of page 2. So just on page 1 up until page 2, I'm going to ask you to read the story, and much like we did in the last session, I'm going to ask you to generate as many questions as you can about the story, both in terms of like big questions or just structural questions, what seems strange, what's out of place. And then we're going to talk about it a little bit, and then we're going to look at some other texts that's going to help shed some light on this story. So in order to do that, I'm going to ask you to read it with in groups of two or, if necessary, three, and ask the questions, any question that you can about the story. There's no wrong question. If you want to jot it down, you can. We'll take a few minutes to do that, so stand up if you need to. Move over in earshot of someone else. Read the story out loud. And ask as many questions as you can.
They brought him out in court of judgment. He said to them, "Why upon the judges' reason?" Said to the brethren, "Judges,
since we, I was saying, so too.
Once I was walking in the promenade of the forum,
right, so this is the Roman
I found the Yaakov of the village of the
city. He was unbelievably
witnessed. Yeshua saw my thing. And I enjoyed it. I was in a rush to the words of Jericho, violated words of Torah. So far away from
the people who don't know who's talking.
For many are those who have struck dead.
Yeah, that's true.
The lizard used to say,
really.
Pushing out the from ugliness and from which
so what's this about?
So it must be based upon the response that part of our set for he said to him,
yeah, I mean, I guess the big question at that risk is what are the words that he's been teaching and learning?
Okay.
So when I left the court, he was saddened that he was arrested on suspicion of being a heretic. His students entered to comfort him, but he didn't receive them. Rabbi Akiva entered and said to him, Rabbi, may I say a word before you? Perhaps you will know what to do. He said, say. He said, perhaps one of my means that you were heresy and enjoyed it. He said, my Adam, you reminded me once I was walking through the prominence of Tzipori. John Yaakov was the one of Sahamin. He said, a word of heresy from Yeshua. Kateri. Keep yourself far away from him. That's weird. From this account of the story, it sounds like it was the Jews who were arresting him.
Right. It seems like he intentionally says that his intention is being outside of the judge, like pretending it to be just a tutor.
Yeah, I think that's.
Because then why is he upset?
Rely on what I'm saying.
Why he has no idea why he was arrested.
Yeah.
But he says, well,
well, and I would think that if the Romans are arresting him for heresy, then they don't know what heresy is. He's a big Jew in the first place. And that being arrested is a heresy for being the Jew.
I guess the word Paris, and there's something about being an elder.
The whole conversation with the Roman is totally.
Like, I get the end of the message. I mean, what could have happened? Like, he didn't remember when he was, like, hearing.
Right, like what is it about Rabbi Akiva asking him this question that suddenly makes him remember?
Well, no, I think he's differentiating between the audience. They were the very same. It's like the time
Well, then there's, I mean, that line at the end, let a person always run from ugliness, and that resembles ugliness, but enjoying the teachings, then are they really ugliness?
Well, there, I think maybe it's a bit of like the source, someone said you were not like to your friends.
Take about 30 more seconds, okay? Okay, let's bring it back together. I love the story. Okay, let's read the story and then I want to hear your questions. Maaseh Rabbi Eliezer. There was a story where Rabbi Eliezer, Shenitpas al divrei minut, who was tofes. How would you translate
tofes? Yeah, caught.
Caught up, perhaps. Caught up by words of heresy or Jewish Christian teaching. Ve'elu oto le'bama ladun. And they brought him up to the bama. This is what I was referring to earlier, the bima, the stage. This was like you were on stage, but here in a court setting, to be judged. Amar lo oto hegemon, the hegemon, the ruler, Roman commander, says to him, Zaken kamorcha ya'asok b'dvarim halalu? An elder like you, do you really busy yourself in these words? Amar lo, he says to him, Ne'eman dayan alai. He says to him, I rely upon the judge's reasoning. Or literally, the judge is believable to me. Okay, a little bit opaque. The hegemon thought that he was talking about him, that is to say the Roman ruler, but in fact, he was referring to his father in heaven. Amarlo, the hegemon says, the ruler says, Ho'il ve'emantani alecha af ani kach amarti. The hegemon says, since I am a reliable witness, I am believable for you, so too I will say, Efshar she'asevo halalu to'im b'dvarim halalu. Is it possible that these elders are lost in these words? Dimos, pardon, you are exempt from judgment. Hariata patur. That's scene one. Now we go to scene two. Ukeshe niftar min abama, when he was pardoned, or when he niftar, when he left the court, the bama, hayam mitzta'er, shenitpas al divrei minut, he was upset that he had been captured or captivated by divrei minut, these heretical words. Nichnesu talmidav l'nachamo v'lo kibel. His students came in to comfort him, but he did not receive them. Nichnas Rabbi Akiva, but Rabbi Akiva entered and says to him, Rabbi, omar lefanecha davar shema ein atam meitzar. Rabbi, may I say a word before you? Perhaps you will not be troubled. Amar lo emor. He said to him, say. Amar lo, shema achad min aminim amar lecha davar shel minut v'hanacha. Perhaps one of the minim said to you a word of minut, of heresy, and you enjoyed it. Amar, he said, Hashamayim iskartani, by heaven you have reminded me. Pam achat, hayiti me'alech bi'istartia shel tzipori. One time I was walking in the promenades of Tzipori. Matzati Yaakov ish kvar sachnin. I found Jacob, or James of the village of Sachnin. He said, "Va'amar davar shel minut mishum Yeshua ben Pantiri v'hana'ani." He said a word of heresy from Jesus of Pantiri, Yeshua ben Pantiri, son of Pantiri. That's a whole mess. And I enjoyed it. V'nitpasti al divrei minut she'avarti al divrei Torah, and I was caught by words of minut that I violated the words of Torah, which says, "Harchik me'aleha derekachav, al tikrav al petach beita." Keep yourself far away from her and don't approach the opening of her house. Ki ravim chalam hipila. For many are those that she has struck dead, and numerous her victims. From Proverbs, Shaya Rabbi Elazar Omer. For Rabbi Elazar used to say, "Le'olam yehi adam boreach mina kiur umina domela kiur." Let a person always run from ugliness and from that which resembles ugliness. What a story! Okay, let's hear a little bit of your questions. What are some of the questions that you have about this story? Yeah. Who should be accusing him of heresy? Okay. Why is he on trial by the Romans for heresy as opposed to a Jewish one? And I'll just say, to give a little bit of historical context, until the conversion of the Roman Empire, Christianity was a capital offense. You could not be a Christian in the Roman Empire before it became the Holy Roman Empire. And as a result, there were people who were put on trial for believing Christianity. But nevertheless, your question is right, which is to say, why is this happening external to the rabbinic debate? If Rabbi Eliezer is someone who is drawn in by some teaching of Jesus, then why isn't that playing out in the academy, and why is it instead playing it out on the Roman court? Okay, good. Other questions? Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, because whatever the Romans are accusing him of is not what he's really being punished for.
Say more.
Well, because there's two different ideas of what heresy means that are going on in this story. Is what the Romans mean, which is probably some kind of political crime where you hung out with the wrong people and we think those guys, you know, want to overthrow us, something like that. Because really, what do they care what you believe and who you sacrifice to? Right. But Rabbi Eliezer takes his being arrested on that, which is probably just some screw-up, you know. But there's a meaning in it. This wouldn't just happen. This must have happened for a reason.
Good. Okay, so what is the correlation between the fact that he was arrested and this incident that he remembers, which either the Romans had like an incredible secret service that they like figured out that was happened, or there's something about he knows that he has something that in fact he was brought to trial because he had violated a word of Torah, if not because the Romans were such good at ferreting out all of his actions and reading his smartphone. Okay, yeah, Seth.
And what are these words of heresy that have both Rabbi Eliezer and the Romans so upset?
Yeah, good. What was the word? What wouldn't you like to know? What was the word that he enjoyed from, you know, that got transmitted from the teaching of Yeshua ben Pantiri that he enjoyed so much? By the way, this story I brought to you, this is the earliest version of this story from the Tosefta. The story shows up in two other places in rabbinic literature. Where there are versions of what's teaching, but I think what the core of the fact that it was the teaching itself is anonymous or is cloaked in some mystery in the original version, I think is probably very significant. Okay, so what was this teaching? Yeah, what else?
I was going to say this whole idea of him being exempt because he was an elder was this commonplace. If you were elderly, that you would have been exempt from some of these laws and judgments, or that they'd be more lenient towards you, when in fact maybe they shouldn't be, because somebody who's elderly should know better.
Good.
So I'm just kind of wondering how that...
Yeah, what's the relationship between the elderness of Rabbi Eliezer and his dismissal from the court? And shouldn't he be more responsible for being an elder as opposed to less responsible? Yeah.
It seemed to me like they were saying that because you're so old, people of your age are sort of confused by these things and don't really know what you're doing.
Yeah, so is it that you're so old and therefore liable to be confused, or is it you're so old equals wise and couldn't have ever been caught up in the silliness?
So
right?
The elders are lost in these words.
Yeah, to'im bidvarim halalu, who, you know, literally to'eh, like a ta'ut, a mistake, who make mistakes in these things. So I think you could read that either way. Like, is it possible that elders could be making mistakes either because they're elderly and are confused or making mistakes. So elderly people, they know too much to get caught up in this. They wouldn't make that mistake. Yeah.
I was kind of curious about the exchange between the hegemon and Rabbi Eliezer and whether it suggested some familiarity between them.
That they know each other.
Right, because Rabbi Eliezer kind of appeals to the strength of his own character, right? He says, since I am a reliable witness, and the hegemon seems to advise that.
Since who is a reliable witness?
Since I, Eliezer, am a reliable witness.
Sorry, it's confusing, and it's even confusing for the Roman judge there. I think what he's saying is Ne'eman Dayan Alai means the judge is I rely upon the judge's meaning, or to say the judge is believable to me. Ne'eman Dayan Alai, not that he himself, not that Eliezer is trusting himself, but that either the judge, lowercase j, the hegemon, is believable to me, or the uppercase j, the judge of all judges, God, is believable to me. That's sort of a little bit of the play that he's playing there. But I don't think that's Rabbi Eliezer himself is believable to himself. But your question about do they know each other? Does the hegemon know him? Does he think he knows him? Right? He's sort of like, oh, a guy like you wouldn't get into this thing either because you're too confused or because you're too smart for that. You know, what is their relationship? Is there some pre-existing, or does he think he knows him? Yeah, Michael.
I wanted to raise something about the interaction with Rabbi Akiva.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know. I mean, I'm going to just don't really know anything of Rabbi Eliezer's stature, but I do know something about the story of Rabbi Akiva. So if Rabbi Akiva is addressing him as rabbi, I'm assuming that he has a very high stature then within the hierarchical, you know, whatever, as a learned person and all the rest of that stuff. And what I find to be fascinating is it would be one thing if he said, I was walking the promenades of Sipori, I ran into this guy, James, Yaakov, whomever, and he said something to me, and whatever, okay? But he specifically says that he said words of heresy, defines it as words of heresy, he attributes it to Yeshua, whether or not that's, you know, Jesus or whatever, and he then admits that he enjoyed what he heard. He didn't just enjoy hearing, talking about, you know, the basketball last night.
Right.
Specifically admits in his conversation with Akiva that he enjoyed hearing words of heresy.
Yeah, that's a big deal. And just to contextualize where Rabbi Eliezer is in the Seder Dorot, in the rabbinic history, so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is the, let's call him the first rabbi, right? He's the one who establishes Yavne, and he does it, if you remember, in another story in Masachet Gittin, he escapes the city of Jerusalem in the destruction era through a coffin, right? And if you remember, he's carried in this coffin out of the city of Jerusalem. He sneaks out of the city of Jerusalem to go see the emperor, and the emperor gives him Yavne, and that's the sort of beginning of rabbinic Judaism and the rabbi's telling of it. There are two students who carry him out in this coffin. One of them is Rabbi Yoshua, who we saw last hour, and the other is Rabbi Eliezer. Okay, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoshua, Rabban Gamliel, they're all of the same generation. They're all the students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. They're in the second generation of the Tanaim. He is a major figure, right? And the student of, and Rabbi Akiva is in fact the student of both Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, who himself is the father, the teacher of many later teachers. Okay, so that's part of his context. But your question is very strong, which is to say, how is it that this guy Rabbi Eliezer, who is like one of the founding members of the Yavne Academy, is admitting that he was enjoyed? And I should say a word about Yeshua ben Pantiri. It's Jesus. I mean, the question of what Pantiri means, there's a whole scholarship around that. One theory is that it's panther, like it sounds like it a little bit. One theory is that it was just a Roman name. One theory was that it was a Roman soldier. But all of these are not God. That is to say, if Jesus is the Son of God, not in the Talmud, right? Jesus is the son of a panther, of a Roman soldier. You know, it's like all these negative things that you could come up with for Jesus. Yeah.
But Jesus is dead by this time.
True.
So whoever, it can't be unless
But it's a teaching transmitted from Jesus to Yaakov of Sechnin.
Yaakov is transmitting a word of heresy. He's attributing it to Jesus.
Right. It's a teaching of Jesus that this guy, Yaakov of Sechnin, who appears in a couple other stories as a Christian teacher, is transmitting. Okay, yeah. What would be the what?
What would be, the heresy would be that Jesus was the Messiah. But Jesus didn't say that. That's a view that came later, so I'm mystified.
Well, what's interesting here is we don't even know what the teaching was, but the point is, by this point, if it had been said by Jesus, it doesn't even matter what he said. The fact that it was said by Jesus means that it was A, against Roman law, and therefore you could get on trial for it, and B, called divrei minut, at least by Rabbi Eliezer. Now, the question of the authorship of this story and how that relates to like the actual real-life character of Rabbi Eliezer is another question, but even the author of the story is probably only about, let's say 100 years after Rabbi Eliezer himself. So either way, you're talking about latest 3rd century. But still, that's the issue here is Jesus said something. I'm not supposed to listen to Jesus' teachings, and I did. Yeah.
Not only listened, but you enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I liked it. It was good. I heard the sermon. I turned on television on Sunday morning, and yeah, the guy said something good. Yeah, you were going to say.
I have two things that probably. One is that he was part of the Jewish people, by the Romans. And then he leaves, and he was that. You would think that if he was pardoned, he would be happy.
Yeah, right? You get pardoned. He's on trial for his life, and he gets pardoned. Then why is he sad? Okay, so that's a great question. Yeah?
The second question I have is, I find it curious that he didn't receive the students. Why didn't he receive the students? But he did talk to Rabbi Akiva.
Good. Why is it Rabbi Akiva is the only one who can penetrate the wall, who is a student of his, whereas all the other students are not able to offer him any comfort, or at least he's not willing to receive them so that they could comfort him?
My question is, why wouldn't he receive the comfort?
Good. Why wouldn't he receive the comfort? I would love to have some comfort, especially if I knew that I was upset, even though I had made it out of the Roman court. Yeah.
Taken up by the Roman court, and then in talking to Rabbi Akiva, it's like, well, maybe they picked me up because this thing happened to me in the past. And so it also feels like there's some sort of disconnect of, like, what is it that actually happened now? Why is he being picked up on trial now? And so maybe that's where that sadness comes from, is he has this guilt because he thinks, oh, I know why they would have taken me in, even though the Roman court decided that it's not.
Yeah, there's some leftover guilt. And let me just strengthen your question by adding one other piece of fact, which is, in the Roman court system, you could not be anonymously charged. Someone had to turn you in, right? Someone had to claim that you were Amin. So now the question also is, how did he end up in court anyways? You're saying it wasn't this event that happened so long ago, and the Roman spy was there watching it, but someone turns him into the Roman court. Who is that and why? Okay? That's another aspect here. Yeah.
It has certain vocabulary that echoes another text on Sanhedrin 17a when a Sanhedrin votes a man unanimously guilty, they have to let him go. And also on that, one of the qualifications for being on the Sanhedrin is being a master sorcerer. And the Rashi on that says that so that you would know if someone is like Jesus of Nazareth. And I think also, like, Rabbi Eliezer has lots of history, saying words, like, I think it's Sanhedrin 60-something, where he says words and uproots an entire cucumber field.
Yeah, good. I brought that text as the last text in the sheet here, the one about the cucumbers. But the important thing that you're raising is Christianity was known, and if you sort of read the New Testament with this lens on, it's very clear. Christianity was known for magic in some ways, right? Jesus was a healer. This is this same Yaakov character, in the halakha right before this one in the Tosefta, he is offering to heal one of the rabbis. This is what Christians did. They were healers. And there was some magic element to that. And Rabbi Eliezer himself has some experience with magic. So Is it just one thing that Rabbi Eliezer heard, like one time, I was in the market, I happened to hear something, I happened to like it, oy, you know, that brought all this thing? Or is there something deeper about his connection to the Christian magic world that is leading him to here? And where's the other example of Rabbi Eliezer and magic that we might remember from,
the I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think,
yeah.
I think also it's one of the reasons that Akiva gets in, because in the story of the cucumber field, it's Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer.
Correct. In this story, we're going to see it, the story of the cucumbers, for those who are not familiar with it. Awesome story. It's here on the last page. But the basic sort of format of it is the students come, and Rabbi Eliezer has this harsh dialogue with them. And then Rabbi Akiva comes, and he's able to actually penetrate the dialogue. There's another example of that as well, which is Rabbi Akiva is sent in the story of Tanur Shelach Nai to break the news to Rabbi Eliezer that he's been kicked out of the academy. All right, well, since you raised all the other stories, let's take a look at some of them, and then hopefully this will answer some of the questions that we have here about these about this story. So first of all, I would ask a question of, oh, Hashamayim is Kartani, by heavens, you reminded me, Rabbi Akiva, right? You reminded me about that time, once a long time ago. Here I was, I'm Rabbi Eliezer, I don't know why I'm being accused of being a Christian, and you reminded me, and now I remember. Turns out Rabbi Eliezer is the guy who never forgets anything, right? He's on page 3. Rabbi Eliezer, Ben Horkanus, that's his father's name, Bor Siche no Me'abed Tipa. He is a plastered cistern who never loses a drop. Do you think that this plastered cistern who never loses a drop, that is to say, he is the ideal receptacle of the stuff that comes before him, would have forgotten that he had this interaction with this this teacher of Jesus' teachings?
It isn't to say that he forgot, he just didn't make the connection.
But he's Kartani. You reminded me. So maybe I didn't forget, but I don't know, blocked it out, or...
I didn't make the connection between what I was listening to and what they might arrest me for.
But he's arrested for Minut, and he remembers that he had Dibre Minut, so maybe he didn't classify it as Minut until then, maybe. I mean, that's one way. Okay, so that's one question I had. I raised a few other questions, by the way, on the last page here, on page 4, some of which we've covered. Why was he suspected as a Christian? Who turned him in? Why didn't Rabbi Eliezer just deny? Is it a little weird? Rabbi Eliezer could have said, they said, are you a Christian? Now there's two ways to deny being a Christian in the Roman world. One is to make a sacrifice to the emperor. They cared only that you're sacrificing the emperor. You could sacrifice whoever else you wanted, but you also sacrifice the emperor. Jews couldn't do that. The other way they could do it is curse Jesus. Like, deny Jesus. And he didn't do that. He said this cryptic thing of Ne'aman Dayan Alai. So why didn't he take that out? Saul Lieberman points out that he raises this question about this story. Why didn't he just take the out and curse Jesus? This is what you said. Why was he saddened that he was accused of being a min? You know, there's a lot of times this happens where rabbis are in Roman courts. They make it out and everyone's happy. Why did Rabbi Eliezer refuse to allow the other students to comfort him? Why only Rabbi Akiva could comfort him? If Rabbi Eliezer was known as a cistern that never loses a drop, why did he forget his encounter with Yaakov of Sachnin? Why was Rabbi Eliezer traveling so far from Lod, the home of his yeshiva? Remember, he's in Tzipori. Tzipori's up in the north, right? And Lod is down in the south, like where the airport is, right? So why is Rabbi Eliezer find himself so far away from his yeshiva? Why did Rabbi Eliezer talk to Yaakov of Sachnin? Why interact with Christians at all? Why did Rabbi Eliezer enjoy the teaching? What was it that attracted him to it? And what is the meaning of the end of the story? Always run from ugliness and from that which resembles ugliness. Is there any deeper meaning there? Okay, so but I love the questions that you came up with. Let's take a look at some of this background, other stories, and then we're going to come back and see if we can understand our story a little bit better. Okay, so the Tanur Shelach Nai story is probably the most famous in this generation Talmud story. I don't want to get into the details of it, but I want to get into the details that follow what happens between the fight of, and do you remember who was fighting there? It was Rabbi Eliezer versus everybody, but led by Rabbi Yeshua. Okay? Rabbi Yeshua versus Rabbi Ezra. So Rabbi Yeshua, who was the victim in the last hour, he's the aggressor in this hour. Okay? So this the Zehu Tanur Shel Achnai, this is the story of the oven of Achnai. Rabbi Ezra, claiming that this oven of Achnai is pure, brings supernatural proofs, like the carob tree jumping 100 or 400 amot in the air. But the rabbis, led by Rabbi Yeshua, reject his proofs and claim that heaven cannot help decide matters of law. That's lo b'shamayim hi. It's not in heaven. God laughs. Everybody's happy. Except that actually it turns out to be a tragic story. And here's where the tragedy begins. It was said, Amru, on that day, they brought all the purities that Rabbi Ezra had purified and burned them in a fire. They charged him and excommunicated him. Okay? They said, who will go and inform him? Apparently you could be excommunicated in absentia. Who will go and inform him? Rabbi Akiva answered, I will go, for perhaps someone else unfitting will go to inform him, and he will destroy the entire world. What did Rabbi Akiva do? He wore black, wrapped himself in black, and sat before him, before Rabbi Ezer, at a distance of 4 amot. And this was what it meant to be excommunicated was, you could not breach the 4 amot boundary. You had to be away from someone. You were in nidui. You were pushed aside. You were like a nida. You were outside. Rabbi Eliezer says to him, Akiva, what's so special about today? Rabbi Akiva said to him, it seems to me that your friends are separated from you. He too tore his clothes, removed his shoes, slid off his chair, and sat on the ground. And then the end of the story is that Rabbi Eliezer essentially starts burning things with his eyes and is about to destroy the entire world through the burning. But Ima Shalom, sort of his wife, you know, interjects, realizes that he has all this destructive power. And the last part of the story is that she prevents him from ever having this moment of tachanun, of like real supplicatory prayer. But she gets confused about which day Rosh Chodesh was. She thinks it's Rosh Chodesh, and it's not. And he does this tachanunim, and as a result, his brother-in-law, Ima Shalom's brother, Rabban Gamliel, dies. Like a storm takes over his ship. So it's a bad day. Like the day that Rabbi Eliezer was thrown out of the academy, it's a good day for those who like more democratic law process. It's a bad day for everybody else who was living at the time. And Rabbi Eliezer was kicked out of his yeshiva. He was not, in fact, in the rabbinic discourse anymore. Now this gets to the elderly part. When does our story take place? He's already in the gray-haired stage of life. And in fact, why is he up in Sipori? I want to argue, he's out in Sipori because he's no longer in Lod Yavna area. He's not with the other rabbis. He's traveled away. And he's hanging out in the Galilee, in the bustling city of Tzipori, in the marketplace there. And we'll look at that a little bit more in a second. Let's just take a look at the last exchange. This is the story you referenced in the Sanhedrin 68. Number 5 on page 4. It was taught in a Braita, another early rabbinic text. When Rabbi Eliezer became sick, Rabbi Akiva and his friends entered to visit him. They entered and sat before him at a distance of 4 amot. Okay, so what's the status of him? He's still excommunicated. But they want to visit him because he's on his deathbed. Right? Now this amazing scene. He said to them, why have you come? They said to him, we've come to learn Torah. He said to them, and why haven't you come until now? They said to him, we weren't free. We weren't available. Right? Or because we excommunicated you. You're excommunicated. Right. Now, look at this tragic end to Rabbi Eliezer. He took his two arms and placed them on his heart. He said, woe to you, my two arms, which are like two Torah scrolls rolled shut. Much Torah have I learned, and much Torah have I taught. Much Torah have I learned, but I didn't absorb from my teachers even as much as a dog licking from the ocean. Much Torah have I taught, and my students haven't absorbed but a tiny amount, literally a mascara brush in its tube, a little tiny amount that you would take out with a mascara brush. Now comes the zucchinis, turn the page. Not only that, but I reviewed 300 laws about a bright skin affliction, and no one ever asked me about them. Not only that, but I taught 300 laws, some say 3,000 laws, about planting zucchinis magically, and no one ever asked me a thing about them except for Akiva ben Yosef. Once, he and I were walking on the path. Rabbi Akiva said to me, Rebbe, teach me the planting of zucchinis. I said one word, and the field was filled with zucchinis. He said to me, Rebbe, you taught me their planting, now teach me their removal. I said one word, and they were all gathered into one place. So here you see Rabbi Eliezer recounting on his deathbed, and the scene goes on to actually describe his end, which itself is tragic and beautiful. But here you see him playing with magic. And it's in the context of this mission, remember the mission in Sanhedrin, about planting zucchinis magically, who is liable and who is not liable, and Rabbi Yeshua is the one who's defining who's liable and who's not. So Rabbi Yeshua seems to be this character who is anti-magic / anti-Christian magic, or Christian-inspired magic. And Rabbi Ezra seems to be the guy who is uprooting a carob tree, sending the waters backward, making zucchinis appear and disappear with a word. He's not afraid of that kind of magic, or whatever it is, that kind of power. But it gets him kicked out of the Beit Midrash, right? So he is no longer part of the academy. Now, when he is arrested, now we go back to our story. Let's try to understand our story now, knowing a little bit of the background of these characters. When he is nifpas al divrei minut, I think that you can read it two ways. Either he's arrested for minut, or he is arrested by minut. That is to say, he's drawn to it in some way. There's something about it that draws him in. Again, is he a good Jew or a bad Jew? Is this allowed or not? Something that's not allowed from the Roman court's status, but is it something that is okay or not? Rabbi Yeshua would say no. Now, who brings him to the court in the first place? I don't know, but he doesn't have, let's put it this way, he was on trial once before. He was on trial when he was excommunicated from the Beit Midrash. Right? They voted against him, and he was as good as dead excommunicated. His whole life was up in smoke. He had no more students. He had all this Torah that he wanted to teach. He had 300 laws about a bright spot, about leprosy, and no one ever listened to him. He had 3,000 laws about zucchini. No one ever asked him. Right? He's gone. So who's turning him into the hegemon? Not sure, but maybe his friends, right, his chaverim, who are the ones who are sending him away in the first place from the Beit Midrash. Now, when they ask, Amarlo oto hegemon, zaken kemor chai yasok v'arim halalu, it's an amazing opening question. Like, imagine you're the prosecutor in the courtroom, and your first thing isn't, tell me about what you know, everything you know about, any interaction you've ever had with anybody who ever taught any Christian Torah, as it were, right? Instead, they say, what? Could it be? An elder like you? Could you really be involved in these things? The hegemon has already made up his mind, right? He is the kind of guy who, like a judge, judges someone before him with a predetermined outcome. Rabbi Eliezer couldn't be a guy who gets caught up in Christianity. He's Rabbi Eliezer. He's that guy who's the founding member of Yavne. This couldn't be right, right? Now, when he says, and you can see also the way in which the hegemon is understanding things that he assumes to be correct, but he's actually wrong. Like the only thing that Rabbi Eliezer says to him, Ne'aman Dayan Alai, the hegemon misreads as referring to himself. But in fact, Rabbi Eliezer was speaking about God. Now, and as a result, he sort of says it again, Efshar Shasevu Halalu Toim B'Dvarim Halalu, is it possible that this gray-haired man is making a mistake in these things? No way. You're patur. You're exempt. Now, what's interesting is when, I don't know how much to read into this, but when it says, Velonit Kaven, when Rabbi Eliezer was intending not for the hegemon, but for God, Ne'aman Dayan Alai, the judge is reliable to me, Velonit Kaven Ela Neged Aviv Sheba Shamayim. Aviv Sheba Shamayim, his father, who aren't in heaven. Neged Aviv Sheba Shamayim. Usually you would expect Kineged Aviv Sheba Shamayim. But actually Neged is missing the kid. It's like against his father in heaven. some, perhaps, literary foreshadow of the second half of the story, which is to say, there's some Rebbe Eliezer nakedness against Aviv Shabbat Shamayim that's in this foggy Jesus teaching story that's going to show up in more clarity in the second scene. But I think the first scene for me is, here's a court trial which is not that satisfying from the standpoint of, is this guy guilty or innocent? The judge has already predetermined everything about the court trial. He's walking in there, he knows this guy is innocent, he's going to listen for anything and spin it in his way so that he is able to dismiss him, and indeed that's exactly what happened. In other words, the judge is not a listener, right? He's not a guy who could ever assume that Rabbi Eliezer would have Christian leanings. Enter scene two. And I think this scene one would be a perfectly great rabbinic story. Ha! Look at that great rabbi who's sort of double entendred his way out of his life and death trial. But the fact that Rabbi Eliezer, as you pointed out, is in fact mitzta'er at the end of his trial, he's troubled at the end of his trial, is because there's something deeper that some other process that he needs to go through here. So when it says, Hare ata patur, you are exempt, and then the very next word is ukeshen niftar, when he exempts himself, that is to say, when he leaves, they're connecting scene one and scene two. Scene two relies on scene one. Scene one is the first trial. Scene two is the second trial. And the trial here takes place not with a threatening Roman judge who's going to hang him if he says the wrong words, but instead, the only person who can actually talk to him, the only person who can actually have some dialogue with him, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is the only guy who can do that. And in fact, Nichnesu Talmidav L'Nachamo V'lo Kibel, why didn't he accept those students? What's that? Thanks a lot. Where you been? I had all this Torah to teach. Oh, you weren't free for 40 years? Thanks a lot. So now you want to come and help me and comfort me? I'd rather not. But Rabbi Akiva shows up, and then he says, may I say something before you? And he says, say. Right? So Rabbi Akiva is able to penetrate that. Now, I think what's amazing, and this is a lesson that's useful for us when we think about our own, how do you deal with people who are crossing over the boundary that may be something you are opposed to, right? Is it like the hegemon who say, oh, there's no way this guy could have crossed that boundary. Forget about it. He's Rabbi Eliezer, right? Or like the students who, what were the students going to say? Imagine he let them in. What would they say to him? L'nachamo, to give him comfort. Oh, poor Rabbi Eliezer, how could they have captured you for this? For sure you're not the kind of person who would ever have to go through this ordeal. Only Rabbi Akiva says, wait, maybe there's something going on here that Rabbi Eliezer needs to process and actually explore a little bit deeper, right? He says, Shema, right? Maybe you actually, this is incredibly daring. Perhaps you actually heard some amount of heresy and you enjoyed it. And bam, he hits the nail on the head. Oh, you reminded me. But not, I want to argue, you reminded me as if I forgot. I'm the guy who doesn't forget. It's now I feel like I can talk about this. You're the guy I can share this with. What is that?
I got the impression that Akiva was there also. At the same,
meaning how else would he have known?
Right.
Fascinating. That's very interesting. Implying that Rabbi Akiva is the only one who didn't abandon him in his excommunicated state. And not only that.
And remember when we were at, and you were listening, enjoying that.
That would be very interesting. That would be very interesting if Rabbi Akiva went so far. Now, what's also interesting is that the root of Akiva and the root of Yaakov of Sachnin, Akka, is the same, right? How much you want to make of that? Is there some connection there? Okay, but that's an interesting suggestion. Now, he says, he reminds me, oh yeah, one time I was walking in the marketplaces or in the promenades of Tzipori. Now, what's he doing there? We know he's outside of his Beit Midrash. He's been kicked out of the Torah universe, which is in the south. And I want to argue, he's in the real marketplace of, he's in the cosmopolitan area of, ancient Eretz Yisrael. He's in the place where ideas are free-flowing, where you actually can encounter stuff. He's not in the cloistered Beit Midrash, where everything that's said is already within the rabbinic confines, and if you violate them, you get kicked out like he did. He's out. He's out, and he's wandering around the marketplace, and he runs into, what do you know, somebody who's teaching something that you would never hear in the rabbinic discourse, but is in fact in the marketplace itself. I found this person, Yaakov Ishkvar Sachnin, that is to say, Matsati, I found him, as if to say, I'm looking. I'm looking, and it wasn't like Pagatibo, I ran into him, or I met him. It's I found him. I'm looking, and I found something. And I found something that I was looking for in the marketplace of Tzipori, not in the Beit Midrash, which I've been kicked out of. Matsati, I found Yaakov, and he says to me, a davar shel minut from Jesus, and I in fact enjoyed it. V'nitpasti al divrei minut, shavarti al divrei Torah. And I was caught for, I was arrested by these divrei minut because I violated this this principle of Torah, which is you must keep very far away from it. And the here it's the sexualized image is very intense. It's the door of the prostitute, right? This is this is the illicit relationship that I'm not allowed to have, even though it's alluring, right? And I must keep very far away from the opening to that. Because there are many who have died, or many numerous are her victims. Now the story ends, Rabbi Eliezer said, always keep away from the ugly and from that which resembles the ugly. Now the ugly here could refer to the teaching of Jesus, or, and here I just want to, whether you want to take this hint as far or not, if you turn back to page 4, there is an interchange between Rabbi Yoshua and the Bat Kesar, the daughter of the Caesar. It's in text number 4. Amrale Bat Kesar le Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, the daughter of the Caesar says to Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, let's say our Rabbi Yeshua, Torah mefoara bekli mechoar. You are beautiful Torah in an ugly vessel. And Rabbi Yeshua is known as the ugly rabbi. His day job, because back in those days, rabbis had to have day jobs, his day job was a blacksmith. So he was literally black with the what you needed to do to be a blacksmith in that day. It ruined your physical appearance, and he was known to be a kli mechoar. So is there some subtext hint here of the way in which when Rabbi Eliezer ends the story, he is saying you have to stay away from ugliness, not only the teachings of Jesus, but also my arch enemy who kicked me out of the Beit Midrash, Rabbi Yoshua, who's known as being ugly, and as a result, this is why I'm out here in the market of Tzipori as opposed to in the Beit Midrash. Yeah.
Why didn't Rabbi Eliezer move to a different part of the empire where there was concentrations of Jews and taught Torah there?
Yeah, so good question. Why didn't he just sort of go out on his own and be a startup, excommunicated rabbi, a sort of shmuli boteach, ex-Chabad type, where he would see much success? It's interesting. We don't know, but I'd say in his deathbed scene, it seems like the main thing that he is lamenting is that there weren't people who were approaching him, as opposed to him going out and finding students for himself. I mean, he was waiting for people to come back to him. I had all this Torah to teach and nobody ever asked me. Or when the students come to visit him on deathbed, what took you so long to be here? He doesn't seem like the character who's going out to be the itinerant teacher like Yaakov of Sachnin, but instead is waiting for people to come to him. And they never do. Which is probably also sort of like another tragic aspect of his character. Yeah.
The way this winds up, you get the impression that they're saying is this whole problem came from not following his own advice.
Which advice? Meaning that I should stay away
from ugliness.
Right, right. No, so he seems, again, on the surface reading of the story, and maybe this is actually the deep truth as well, he seems to be self-critical. He says, oh, I really messed up because I know that I should have kept farther away from this stuff, but I didn't. And I'm trying to figure out how much of that is, how much of that is he taking seriously, or is like, what did you expect me to do after I've been excommunicated from the Beit Midrash? There's not a lot of options for me except to go into the marketplace where the door to the prostitute is sort of beckons in front of me. And yeah, I'm going to enjoy some of the Torah that I hear from there, even though I'm going to pay the consequence. Yeah.
Is this also Rebbe Elazar here known as Oscar? Or is that my index confused with someone else?
No, that's someone else, but in the same, that's in a later generation of Rebbe Akiva. So this is the pre-generation.
Okay.
Right, Elisha ben Avuya, Rebbe Akiva, and the two. Correct. It's actually a similar dynamic where Rebbe Meir is both able to is also able to serve two masters. One of them is Rebbe Akiva, and one of them is Elisha ben Avuya. Even though Elisha ben Avuya sort of self excommunicates, and here Akiva himself is the guy who serves two masters, Rebbe Yeshua and Rebbe Ezer, one of whom was excommunicated. But it sort of predates that particular example of heresy. Yeah.
I think Eliezer was guilty. He knew he was guilty. He had admitted guilt in front of the Hegemon. Akiva knew he was guilty, and the story was cleaned up in the end with these quotes.
to make him seem like, oh, I made a mistake. Yeah. But yeah, and I think
he knew it. He was guilty. I did it.
Look, and from that perspective, this is the question about whether it was right to excommunicate him. You know, when he was violating the rabbinic discourse around legal debates, where I'm sorry, we can have a debate about whether this is pure or impure, but you can't argue in your favor by uprooting a carob tree, not because that you call upon God's word to stand behind you and we down here are going to reject God's word, lo bashamayim, and instead say it's all up to us, democratic sort of legal discourse. But in fact, the rules of uprooting a carob tree is magic. And that's Christian, and that's something that we are not going to follow. And that's the way in which there was a reason to excommunicate you. And here's the way in which you might actually side with Rabbi Yeshua and say, yeah, it was harsh, but they had to draw the lines. And I think that's where the question comes is, where do we draw the lines? What flips you over from being a good Jew to a bad Jew, such that you could not come back? Where are you, Elisha ben Avuya, where the heavens will never accept you and your tshuva? Is Rabbi Eliezer able to, you know, is he meant to be excommunicated?
He never tried to do tshuva. He was he until the day he died. He said, "I was right. Why did they listen to me?"
And even on his deathbed, the last law that he teaches, well, the very last law he teaches is actually about Tara, but the second to last law that he references is about these magic zucchinis, which gets him into trouble. You're saying he doesn't go back on.
He has no tshuva there. He believes it. He believes it from the beginning until the end, and he admits it. And, you know, let God be my judge. You know, he can punish me the way he will. You can punish me, doesn't matter.
Uh-huh.
This is what I believe.
Uh-huh. Okay, yeah.
Why do they decide that what he's doing is impure when they also acknowledge in the same breath that the power for his magic comes from heaven?
Right, I think... that's part of the paradox of that story is... how much are they, when the carob tree uproots, is it heaven that is to say, is it God's pure word that's backing Rebbe Eliezer? Or is it something where you have some heaven-backed ability to do something, but that's not allowed for us? Like you're playing with unfair rules, even if there's some heaven-granted ability that makes you do it. Like nobody says, oh, it was just a magic trick. That's actually the debate in the Mishnah about this is whether if the zucchini planting is just a trick, you're not chayav. If it's real magic, then you are chayav. So there's something about Rabbi Ezra where like what they're upset about is that he's actually playing with real magic, which has to be backed by heaven, as opposed, I mean, we draw these bright lines between like religion and magic. Like one is totally fine and we pay dues to shul, and the other one is like, you know, crazy and you would never do. But in those days it was also blurry, you know, and for Rabbi Ezra, you know, he didn't go back on it. It's like, I can tell you like rabbinic law and I can tell you about magic zucchinis and it's all one for me and that's not a problem. So I think that's part of the issue is that it was in some ways divinely sanctioned magic or divinely ability, the ability to do magic was divine, but it was not sanctioned in the discourse of the Beit Midrash, even though it...
Well, they didn't like it. They couldn't do it.
Right, so maybe they're just jealous. Yeah, yeah.
I was going to say, I mean, Rabbi Eliezer is right. I mean, we know from the Tanur Ta'achnai, like, the voice of God comes down and says, like, not only is Rabbi Eliezer here correct here, he's correct everywhere. And I think that, I mean, part of his, like, greatness in as a teacher comes from the fact that he does play with fire. Like, he is kind of, like, the new security guard at the bank who used to be a bank robber. And, like, that's what makes him have a lot of insights.
Yeah, he knows he's not afraid of the... of all the tools that would come up with the truth in some ways. And he's able to do that. I mean, by the way, the way in which they describe him in the in that story is how you get excommunicated. A synonym for excommunicated, not only is nidui, but it's also shamoti. He's often called in other places shamoti, which comes from Shammai. Shammai was the other guy from the last generation who was labeled as out. Now, it's not that they, excoriated all of his rulings, but we don't follow Shammai, Beit Shammai, in anything, right? So there's this process of winnowing down who gets to hold on to the truth and who has to, sort of say, no, you're out. And that happens in each generation as we sort of move down through the Tanaim. So anyways, I want to wrap up, but I leave you with this story as an opportunity to see somebody who is quoted all over the Mishnah and the Talmud, and we learn many laws from Rabbi Eliezer, but nevertheless, as a character in rabbinic literature, is somebody who has a complex relationship, say at least, with his colleagues, and also a complex relationship with truth and religion and religious teachings that may stem from places outside the Beit Midrash, which he himself was kicked out of. Thank you.